There are a few golden eras of auto racing, and the early 60s are among them. 3 years of pure innovation, adding horsepower and speed, improving aerodynamics and tire composition, tweaking fuel formulas and engine design. Hardly any rules or regulations to get in your way. And now imagine watching as that very same innovation crashes, burns, not just in the flames, into a giant fireball, an impenetrable screen of flames and black smoke. A crash so big it killed 2 people, halting a 1 million person event, and almost killed the sport of racing dead in its tracks. That's what happened at the Indianapolis 500 in 1964. This particular year, the Indy 500 was riding high. The race hadn't had a casualty for 5 years, and there was an estimated crowd of over 1 million fans. And in the post-war era, motorsport was more popular than ever. But on May 30th, 1964, everything changed. One of the worst crashes in Indy history. A crash so bad it stopped the race, something that had never happened before. Today on Pass Gas, 1964 Indy 500. What made it one of the most awful days in racing history? Who was to blame for the 2 casualties? And ultimately, what did the tragedy lead to in terms of the Indy 500 and racing in general? We're giving you the whole story of the year they red flagged the Indy 500. So light up your cigarette and don't buckle your seatbelt, as your car doesn't have one. It's 1964, and we're hitting the most famous oval in the world.
Pass Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about sports.
The UFOs of the ground are called race cars.
Yes, they are. Very good. Good segue. This is Pass Gas. I'm your host, Nolan Sykes, joined as always by my 2 other hosts, James Hoppus Pumphrey over here.
Don't leave me all alone.
And Joe Kardashian Weber.
No, Barker.
Barker. Yeah. How's it going between bits?
Nolan DeLong Sykes. Where are you?
Yeah.
Do you know, have you ever heard the explanation of why UFOs look weird in our atmosphere? Why they can just go in straight lines and then like switch?
No, but I will pay you $50 to explain it to me right now.
Okay. So have you ever heard of like the fourth dimension hypercube theory?
Okay, I think we missed like 5 steps.
Okay, third dimension is X, Y, Z axis, right?
Right, okay.
So if you add a fourth dimension, our brains are not capable of comprehending it. When fourth dimension objects move in three-dimensional worlds, they look like they're going in weird lines because they're going in between dimensions. So that's one of the theories of why spaceships look like they can just like go one way and then stop right away and then go the other way.
I kind of think that's
like a thing where it's like, yeah, and then all of a sudden it's just like,
yeah. I'll show you the video because like it explains it a lot better. It's cool.
I've always understood that the fourth dimension
since I was a baby.
Since I was a baby, I always knew that the fourth dimension was time though. How does that factor into it?
It's like the Tesseract is the fourth dimension, which is the hypercube. And that's like a cube inside of a cube. And it just trying to explain it is like breaking my brain right now. So
gonna have to hit that CBD pen before I dive into this, it sounds like. Anyway, this is a car podcast, not a Kardashian extraterrestrial podcast, as much as I would like to do one of those.
That'd be sick.
Hey, why haven't the Kardashians done anything with cars yet?
Well, Joe, there's that famous episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians where Kim gets her first Bentley, if you haven't seen that one, and then it just becomes a whole thing.
Gets her first Bentley, and then she goes to Del Taco, and then she cries because she totally shits her pants.
That classic episode.
Kris Jenner and Brody Jenner both like shit their pants too in the back. And they just fucking all shit their pants. It's terrible. Cool, the 60s.
Yeah. The 60s was a new era in motorsport. Many of the people interested in racing were World War II vets craving an adrenaline rush. Most of these drivers had day jobs and raced on nights and weekends. As more and more people became interested in cars and racing, smaller racetracks, known as bull rings, typically less than half a mile long dirt tracks, started popping up all over the country. There's a few in Slow County, where I'm from. Santa Maria Speedway. There was one actually in Atascadero. There was a short dirt oval. It got paved over though. Anyway, This provided a space for all these new hobbyists to try their hand at racing. And the goal for most everyone became the Indy 500, the one oval to rule them all. Even in the 60s, making it to the Indy 500 was a tall order. In the years before, drivers trying to make it to the big race would travel the country looking for a feature race. A track owner would offer a couple $100 to the winner, and this prize would attract better drivers and big crowds. These young drivers would stay in motel rooms, sometimes 4 or 5 guys per room, work as their own mechanics, and live off the occasional $100 grand prize. They're all just trying to earn some money and impress a team owner so they could get to Indy. I mean, this is pretty common in the day. I knew a guy named Mike Savelli, who was a big-time sprint guy back in the day. And, I mean, to this day, no, not sprint car. This guy, Mike Savelli, he's a big-time like drag racer, kind of different. But, like, this was a super common lifestyle back then. You're just, like, a traveling, like a bard in a way, a bard of racing, going from city to city all over the country, never really having a home, you know, staying with any team owner house you could. Like, you know, it's just like...
It's really like being in an independent band and, like, touring. We've covered a number of guys that are like this, like Smokey Eunuch had a similar story. Yeah, you don't have a lot of factory backing or, like, big sponsorship money, so you're just kind of...
Yeah. I mean, back then, man, you were just really doing racing for the love of it. There was, besides like getting your grand prize, that it's not like that was going to your savings account for your retirement. No, like that was just so you could have gas money, you get beer and gas for your next race. You know, yeah, that was kind of it.
Please tip the traveling band. Please tip the traveling racer.
Yeah.
Like just literally staying at people's houses because all you had was your truck and your trailer, you know.
And you don't even need food. Beer has enough calories to sustain you.
Yeah. Anyway, not only was the lifestyle of racing more rough and tumble, the sport as a whole was more dangerous, with a lot fewer rules and regulations. By the 1950s, there was a concerning trend that was right there for anyone to notice. The technology and the speeds of the cars was outpacing the matching rules and safety practices. The sport was getting so dangerous that in 1955, Formula One world champion Alberto Ascari, who we mentioned in our very first Ferrari episode, Vukovic actually died while racing at Indy in 1955 when his car somersaulted through the air and burst into flames. 2 weeks later, at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, a racer crashed into the grandstands, killing the driver and 3 onlookers. Finally, when 2 more Indy drivers died later that year, there was a backlash.
Wasn't there also that Formula One crash at Le Mans? Or it wasn't Formula One.
It was a Le Mans crash. I believe it killed like 55 people.
Yeah, 80 people were injured.
Something like that, yeah. Because Mercedes and a Jaguar got into it.
Yeah, someone was coming out of the pits and like took a cut across the track for some reason.
It was a whole mess, yeah. We also mentioned that in our Ferrari series from the very beginning of the show. Anyway, the death rate got so bad that the American Automobile Association, which had been supporting auto racing since 1904, said that they would no longer sanction motorsport. This led to General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, and American Motors, all AAA members, this is different than the auto club, to pull their support from auto racing. Countries such as France, Germany, Spain, and Switzerland banned racing altogether until new safety measures and rules could be put into place. Mercedes and Jaguar both withdrew from the sport. All of this had almost no effect on the popularity of motorsport. Fans kept coming to races, and drivers kept racing. Not despite of the danger, but because of it. And the car companies eventually gave up on trying to pull their support. By 1964, there were dozens of rising stars. All of them had started at those bullring races, all ready to prove their worth.
So why was 1964 a boiling point for Indy? Well, there were a few different factors. A big change in 1964 was the design of the Indy cars. The technology was improving rapidly. The old roadster design was out, and the new mid-engine car was in. What is surprising was how quickly it all changed. Between 1953 and 1963, there hadn't been much change to the design or engineering of the cars racing in Indy. In fact, during that entire decade, of the 330 cars that qualified for Indy, only 21 were powered by something other than the traditional Offenhauser or Offy engine. I follow Offenhauser on Instagram.
Oh, they're still around?
It's a great account. Yeah. Really fun.
Yeah, I mean, Offenhauser, they're also super big. You could think of them as like the American like Cosworth in a way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Of those 21 cars that weren't traditional Offenhauser engines, 8 were supercharged versions of the traditional Offenhauser engine. 10 were supercharged Novi engines. 2 were supercharged Cummins diesels. And 1 was a Ferrari.
That's crazy that a couple diesel engines were in there.
Yeah, right? What's strange to look back on is that this loyalty to the Offy was not because of the rules of Indy. In fact, the rules and regulations of the sport were very lax. There was no weight limit, no horsepower limit, no rules on the type or amount of fuel a car could carry, but there had been very little development or advancement of the cars at Indy since it restarted after World War II. A big part of this may have been the lack of materials and resources after the end of the devastating war. But by the end of the 50s, things was starting to change. Cue that Creedence song.
Burning.
It ain't me. Yeah.
The helicopter noise.
By the early 60s, mid-engine designs were gaining in popularity. Most of this innovation came from Europe. It all started with the Englishman John Cooper. Cooper started building small mid-engine machines in the late 1940s, and in 1957, he started bringing them to F1 races. The Australian driver Jack Brabham was the first to drive a mid-engine Cooper-built machine in the F1 post-war era. F1 post-war era sounds like a sick
Midwest just, emo band.
Yeah.
Oh, I was thinking like just a bass player and a drummer. And like new soul. Like kind of like Death
Black
from
Keys
Above.
Kinda?
Like yeah, like Death from Above. 1979. Yeah. Yeah. We're called F1 post-war era.
We're the post-war kids.
Yeah. It turned out to be a great decision on Brabham's part. He went on to win 5 consecutive GP races in 1960, driving Cooper's mid-engine car. After the season ended, Brabham, who was friends with Indy driver Roger Ward, arranged a practice run at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. After the practice run, Ward agreed to let Brabham race his mid-engine Cooper car in the 1961 Indy 500. That's like Lewis Hamilton going to like Indy and being like, yeah, mate. Why don't you just take a couple laps on her? Oh, you like it? Yeah, go ahead and race it in Indy 500.
Wait, why is Lewis Hamilton Australian?
He's not. <suddenly? laughs> He's not. He's just. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, mate. Why don't you take my car?
You sound like Taika Waititi.
That's what Lewis Hamilton sounds like.
No, he doesn't.
He does.
Nah,
he sounds. Mike. He's like cool. He's like very laid back, like very nice.
Oh yeah, he's like. I think he talks. He does have like a high pitched voice though.
A little bit of nasal.
Yeah, it's a little nasal. It's like, hey, oh cool. So, you like the car?
You know, we're gonna get a million comments that are like, oh, James. James just does. Reads these scripts so he can do an English accent.
Well, yeah,
I do. Why do you think we do a podcast?
But I earn it.
Yeah.
Hey, mate. Or I'm Lewis King Hamilton, and I brought my Mercedes here to Indianapolis, Indiana. Why don't you take a couple laps around this here course?
Yeah, that's Lewis Bricktop Hamilton.
You like it? Well, why don't you drive it in the next NASCAR race, my little piggy?
Everything he's saying is really nice, but he says it really aggressively.
Mm-hmm. The mid-engine Cooper design wasn't a perfect Cinderella story. Brabham placed 9th and ultimately decided not to come back to the Indy in 1962. But the changes had been set in motion, and the mid-engine car was there to stay. With Cooper and Brabham heading back to F1 in Europe, it left then-newcomer Mickey Thompson.
Nice. Ooh, we know him.
I know. To take up the mantle of the mid-engine car. By the time entries for the 64 Indy 500 closed, nearly half of the cars were mid-engine.
MT.
again, this is so like weird. Like, it's a guy brought his F1 car over from Europe, and remember, there's no internet now, so everyone's just like, "Oh, that looks pretty cool." Like, "Oh, you put it in the back?"
Oh yeah, dang, that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
So you don't get like all smoky face and stuff.
No, dude, there's no flames on your face or nothing. And then that is just like, "Well, all right, mate, we gotta go back to England. We're gonna do F1. Mickey, you want to keep this F1 car?" Okay.
Yeah, okay.
There are a couple other factors beyond car design in the danger of the Indy 500. Tires and fuel, for one. For years, what everyone used at the Indy 500 was a fuel combo of alcohol, methanol, or ethyl combined with nitromethane because it added performance. So basically, the cars were running on a methane-alcohol fuel blend. You know, and
alcohol and meth sounds like my 20s. Joe knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we did a lot of pop back then.
Yeah. Yeah, let's start a business.
Let's go to Vanguard.
People were starting to experiment with the gasoline, which had better fuel economy. This caused some tension, and there was some debate over which was better. Lewis Meyer, the co-owner of Offenhauser, whose engines were designed to run on racing fuel and not gasoline, said that gasoline was too dangerous to use in a high-speed oval race like the Indy 500. But many other people pointed out that the race fuel was just as dangerous because alcohol fires were hard to see and almost invisible when they happened.
Yeah, there's those like old race films of the guys just like, ah, and you don't know what's going on because you can't see anything.
Yeah, you're like, are you on fire or do you have ants? Because like ants were also a huge problem back then. But like Nolan, like you used to race like junior dragsters and you guys used methanol.
Yeah,
and
we did.
Weren't you saying that like that's like just a huge fear as a child to
invisibly
burn? Yeah,
like that was
burn.
Like one of the first things my dad told me was like, now look, son, this thing runs on methanol. So methanol, you can't see the flames. So I'm like 10 years old, like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
So what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to face that?
So, it's like, you know, it's pretty much like baseball, except there's invisible flames.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, you're gonna have to put on a helmet, some fire resistant clothing, you're gonna be strapped in with seatbelts that you've never seen before as a child. Oh yeah, and the fire is invisible.
The fire is invisible.
You're gonna rock it to 200 miles per hour.
No, I was like, at 10 years old, you're going like 50. But
but also like to go 50, it's like, well, why don't we just use not a lawnmower engine, and then we don't have to use invisible flame fuel?
Yeah, it's pretty fun. Anyway, let's the debate of race fuel versus gasoline basically came down to horsepower versus economy. Race fuel gave you tons of power. But gas gave you a lot of laps, a lot of efficiency, and many teams were trying to run the race with only 2 pit stops. In fact, the Ford team said they might be able to run the whole 500 with no pit stop. That's outrageous. But it also meant that they had to carry between 80 and 90 gallons of gas.
Oh my God. That's just like a rolling bomb.
Yeah, to put that into perspective, like the average gas tank is probably 15 to 16 gallons, right?
Yeah. My Impreza is like 10.
90 gallons.
Wild.
That's like
3 pickup trucks.
There's like a Mini Cooper waiting for you to move. You're just like filling your gas tank.
Yeah. Sorry, it'll be a few more minutes.
Big tank, sorry. I forgot my Slim Jims. I gotta run in real quick.
Well, into this debate stepped our man, Mickey Thompson. He was known as the King of Pop for the fuel blends that he created. King of
Pop. Before Elvis, mind you.
King of Pop is Michael Jackson.
Yes, Elvis.
Michael Elvis, yes. But Thompson was also starting to work on his mid-engine cars, which offered less space for fuel storage. So what did Thompson do? Well, he started hanging a large, hard rubber bladder on the inside of the rails of his cars. So like he had fuel bladder reservoirs.
Exoskeleton?
Well, this was like in the frame rails of the car.
Oh, okay. So like lower center of gravity, all that weight was just...
He didn't have a huge gas tank, so he just filled the whole car with gas. Like, what are the, like, what, how does that affect handling? Like, just having a ton of liquid.
Well, you're slower, but you have more weight on the tires, so you have more grip. And at the end of your run with less weight in the car, you know, you're probably going to have a harder time putting the power down because now your tires have less grip, both mechanically and with weight, less weight on them. So,
but the also, especially on a oval track, like, aren't you being pulled to the outside?
Yeah.
Of the track?
Like, I mean, you can feel this in when you do like iRacing, for example. Like, you, like, this is still factored in, you know. The beginning of your run, you're fat and slow, but you have reliable grip, and by the end of your run, you're sliding and but you're light, you know.
Yeah.
Look, I've played iRacing. I know exactly what these guys have gone through.
We'll get back to more Pass Gas, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
Another debate taking place was with the tires used at the Indy 500. For years and years, everyone had used Firestone, since the beginning, in fact, and there had been little development in tires. But in 1963, Firestone made Mickey Thompson specialty 12-inch tires for his mid-engine cars. And in 1964, Thompson's racers were specifically designed to run on 12-inch tires. But before 1964, the USAC mandated a 15-inch minimum tire height, making Thompson scramble to rework his cars just months before the race. And this eventually led Thompson to design his own tire.
They're still around today.
Yes, sir. So Thompson was being extremely innovative, but also reckless with safety. His cars now had quickly designed custom tires, fuel bladders hanging on the inside frame rails of the car, making his cars an accident waiting to happen.
They were also full of porcupines. And they had broken mirrors on them and upside down horseshoes. Of course, if you listen to Pass Gas regularly, you already know about Mickey Thompson. If not, go back and listen to our episode on Mickey Thompson. Mickey was an Irish guy with a lot of bravado and a competitive streak. He loved tinkering with cars and was known by the nickname the backyard mechanic, which seems a little underwhelming for someone of that stature.
Yeah.
Like, that's almost an insult. It's like, no, guys, I'm not a backyard mechanic. I'm a world renowned championship.
And his nickname, racing. The hobbyist.
Yeah. The bathroom Madonna. In 1961, he went to his first Indy. This is where he saw Brabham race the mid-engine car. The next year, he came back with his own car in the race, an evolution of the car raced by Brabham and developed with former Cooper engineer John Crosthwaite. It also featured a unique independent rear suspension and a V8 Buick engine. Thompson received 59 of 67 votes in winning the annual Mechanic Achievement Award, a huge accomplishment for a first timer, especially with the nickname the backyard mechanic. It's like, guys, I won like in a landslide the mechanical achievement award.
Yeah, people voted.
I competed with everybody. It's like, okay, yeah, but you did it in your backyard, didn't
you?
Yeah,
right?
No, I did it in your backyard. In a clean room lab. So suffice to say, Thompson had a knack for innovating cars for racing. After that, Mickey went back to Long Beach, California, and started working on his all-new car for Indianapolis in 1963. That year, he had three new cars in the race, in addition to two of his cars from the year before. That's five. But Thompson had difficulty keeping drivers employed because his cars were hard to handle. All that innovation meant Thompson sometimes took chances and cut corners, but he kept innovating. He was obsessed with aerodynamics and streamlining, which were new ideas in the 60s. He kept tinkering with his designs, and for the 1964 Indianapolis 500, he finally had drivers. His old friend Graham Hill and newcomer Dave McDonald test drove Thompson's new design in March before the 64 race. Hill found the new design diabolical. and would not return to Indy to drive Thompson's car. But McDonald was like, I like Diabolical.
I'm loving it.
Yeah. But McDonald was like, do, I'm loving it.
You know what I really like about this car is the sloshing. Every time I take a turn, it feels like the whole car just sloshes around on these tiny tires.
You know, you like you drive a lot of cars and you're like, man, I wish this thing sloshed more. But I like this car sloshes.
It's like being in one of those joke mugs that has like liquid inside the rim of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like one of those pens that you turn upside down and, yeah, and the lady's clothes come off. But it's a car.
And it's a death trap also.
I like death and traps. Do, 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 do. I'm Dave McDonald. Dave McDonald is the love child of Dave Wendy's and Ronald McDonald.
So Thompson had been tinkering with the mid-engine cars and the aerodynamics, but one of the only drivers willing to take a chance on Thompson's designs in the 64 Indy was Dave McDonald. What was it about Dave McDonald that made him such a confident driver? And how did Thompson find his first-time Indy driver from SoCal?
Dude, they were in line at Wahoo's Fish Taco, and they both ordered the same tostada bowl.
Dave McDonald was a shy, timid guy from Southern California. He loved cars and racing, and by the late 50s, McDonald was a top local drag racer. Awesome. He drove a series of Corvettes and held almost every class and strip record in the Southwest. Damn, this guy's sick.
Your grandpa probably knew him, right?
I mean, probably, yeah. I'm probably like 2 degrees removed from this guy. And if he didn't win a race...
Oh, weird. I'm looking at a picture of Dave McDonald. He looks way more like Nolan than Nolan's dad or grandpa.
Whoa, that's crazy. And actually, his order at Wahoo's was the same thing that Nolan always orders at
Nolan,
Wahoo's.
You always order this Baja Tostada.
Anyway, if he didn't win, his wife Sherry would.
Oh, so cool.
That's cool. A little couple action there. That's awesome. Sometimes he would drive through the elimination round, and then his wife, Sherry, would drive in the finals. Dude, that's sick, dude.
Dude, I'm looking at a picture of Sherry, and she looks a lot more like Nolan than Nolan's grandma.
Anyway, not only was McDonald a great driver, he was also a gifted mechanic, and he would do car repairs and tune-ups on the side to help pay for his racing. He especially loved Corvettes. One story claims that McDonald once listened to a customer's Corvette over the phone and successfully diagnosed the issue. That's sick.
That's
this guy's
cool.
Awesome. I love this guy. McDonald's success at the drag strip attracted the attention of Don Steve's Chevrolet, a dealership with a history of racing involvement. Steve, you don't really hear that anymore. There's not like many dealerships outside of like exotics that have race teams. Steve's offered him a job as a driver and mechanic for the 1960 season. And McDonald accepted. As soon as he started racing, it was clear that the man had a gift. In 1961, at Riverside Drag Strip, he set a new class record. He went on to win 9 straight road races to open the season. This guy is just multifaceted. A real Swiss Army knife behind the wheel. All the success started to make McDonald a fan favorite on the West Coast. The best coast, dude. Fans... fans loved his aggressive driving style, and since he had no real training, McDonald drove mostly on feel and intuition. He also loved oversteer, which appropriately earned him the nickname the Master of Oversteer.
Not super
say there goes the Master of Oversteer and his mastery of oversteer.
Look at the Master of Oversteer is talking with the backyard mechanic.
But to most fans, he went by another nickname, The Natural.
Oh, that's way better.
That's way cooler.
Way
McDonald,
cool.
Yeah, McDonald was super aggressive on the track. You know, sometimes he would start at the back and win just to give fans a show. Starting from the back, baby. That's cool. This over-the-top...
Come on. He's like, no way. It's like, I know I qualified P1, but I'm going to go to the back. just to give the people a show.
And he winks at the fans as he's like reversing.
Like, if he is, he needs to go do a harder sport.
This over-the-top driver persona didn't match his real life. As usually after winning a race, McDonald was a quiet guy who liked to sit in the corner of the party and listen to other people talk. You know what? I relate to this guy.
Because he's your grandpa. He's your real grandpa.
He's like 100%.
Cool. Well, anyway, in 1963, Carroll Shelby hired McDonald to drive for him. In his second race, driving a Cobra, McDonald won. And it didn't stop there. He won 8 of his 12 races driving for Shelby. God, how have I never heard of this guy? After racing for Shelby, McDonald was approached by Mickey Thompson, who needed another drive for his car as he'd entered into the 64 Indianapolis 500. This was a huge deal for McDonald. As a self-taught young guy, master of oversteer he was, this would be his first Indy after driving professionally for only a few years.
He taught himself how to be a young guy.
he was a self-taught young man. Before McDonald agreed, he asked the opinion of his crew chief, Pete, who had some foreboding words. Pete, spelled P-A-A-T, warned McDonald, quote,
Think very seriously before driving that car.
he didn't think Thompson had put enough development into the car. McDonald also asked his current car owner, Shelby, for his opinion. Shelby also told McDonald not to do it. In a slightly more blunt quote, Shelby said,
I beg Davy not to and fool with that pile of shit Mickey Thompson built. Nothing added up. Mickey was very smart, but there were too many innovations in it. I said, Davy, please don't drive that car. Please don't get in it. Let's just take a breath, go eat some chili, and have some fun. And he was like, yo, I'm going to drive this car. I was like, okay, well, you want some chili? And he was like, okay. And so he ate some chili, but in the end, he ended up driving the car.
We actually added an extra bladder inside the car just to hold chili.
Chili bladder.
That's actually that chili bladder. That's how the camel pack was invented. It was so that Shelby.
I need some way to warm my shoulders and my back, but also eat chili.
Yeah, so Shelby team drivers could eat chili while they race. Keep giving energy.
So after all that, after all the deliberation and the chili camelback innovation, McDonald agreed to race for Mickey Thompson at the 1964 Indy 500.
The 1964 Indianapolis 500 wasn't just a big deal for Thompson and McDonald. There was another driver ready to compete who had a lot on the line. Someone who had been driving at Indy for years. A guy named Eddie Sachs. Sachs couldn't have been more different than McDonald in both personality and driving style. I've had enough like health problems that I would not be like, even like as a child, I wouldn't have been able to survive in this era, but I do wish I could go to the party.
Yeah.
Like race car parties in like the 60s. So sick. Just like Mickey Thompson, Carroll Shelby. Like they would, dude, guys, they would think we were so funny.
And it's always at a place like called the Starting Line in Riverside.
Yeah. The Checker Stop in Irvine. Yeah. Like we would be like, we'd probably have like a radio show. And like a like vaudeville sort of like USO tour, and do like a Christmas special on CBS every year.
Yeah,
like it's the guys from Donut Media. Hey guys, Donut Media. And he's like, hey, Pumphrey, do your fucking do your one bit. Like we have to put out a video basically every day. But if we lived back then, we'd have to make 4 jokes a year.
Yeah.
And we'd just, they'd be like, hey, say that one joke from 2 years ago. I was like, okay, guys. Hey, what's the difference between a car and a car without a roof? Classic. Eddie Sachs was an over-the-top, charismatic guy, a college dropout just like Kanye West. Sachs started racing cars at 19, but for all of this love of cars, Sachs was not a very good driver. He got his start with midget and sprint car circuits and oftentimes crashed before he even qualified for a race. Eddie was known as much for his personality as his driving. He was a rowdy, wisecracking womanizer who was reckless on and off the track. He was a fan favorite, but his attitude often pissed off fellow drivers. But Sachs loved racing and would do anything to stay in the game. This guy either rules or sucks.
Yeah.
No in between.
He Sachs.
Yeah. Yeah. During the offseason, he worked odd jobs. He was a bellhop in Miami, a cab driver in Los Angeles, and even ran a nightclub. Whatever his side jobs were, he kept coming back to racing, and by 1952, he won his first event. Throughout it all, Eddie's goal was always the Indy 500. He first tried out for Indy in 1953, but failed his rookie test. By 1956, he passed that test, but didn't qualify to drive in the race until 1957. Finally, by the 60s, Sachs had proven his worth and was becoming a sought-after driver. Al Dean, owner of Dan Van Lines.
What?
Dan Van Lines. One of the elite Indy teams was interested in Eddie, but Dean's chief mechanic didn't like Eddie, saying he was loud, almost boastful. His all-consuming interest was selling Eddie Sachs. But Dean hired Sachs.
I don't like him, but I have a lot of other choices, so I'm going to hire him anyways.
Once he was on the team, Sachs was constantly running his mouth and got into fights with fellow drivers, Roger Ward, Jim Rathman, and Parnelli Jones.
Parnelli.
Maybe I'll name my kid Parnelli. Parnelli Pumphrey.
No, Parnelli is a great name.
Parnelli Weber?
No.
Parnelli Sykes?
I think so. I think that's the move.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm going to name my kid Jethro.
Nolan, you should name your kid Soren.
Soren Sykes?
No.
I think you should name your kid Bikeson.
Bison Sykes.
Bison? Yeah. I'm not doing any of those like new agey LA kid names, okay?
What are you going to name your kid then?
Space Captain.
Humphrey James Sykes.
The year before at Indianapolis in 1963, Sachs had lost control of his car and spun out. He partially blamed oil that had been spilled on the track, causing his tires to start sliding. At the victory luncheon after the race, Sachs spent the entire time heckling Parnelli Jones. Sachs was such a jerk during luncheon that Jones didn't even want to talk to him when Sachs came up to him at the bar after the lunch. Jones said that Sachs was lying to reporters, saying that it was Jones who spilled oil that made Sachs lose the race. Sachs then called Jones a liar. Jones responded with, "Call me a liar again, and I will bust right in your mouth." What? Oh no!
I think you said "miss the U."
That's an actual quote.
Call me a liar again, and I'll bust you right in the mouth. To this, Sachs responded, "You're the liar," and as promised, Jones punched Sachs in the mouth, and they wrestled on the ground until separated. That is like. Fights are so embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's just like, you have this like idea that you're going to like do like some like transporter type or something.
Yeah.
But then like, it's like, hey, you want to like stretch out your shirt and get your face real red? And, like maybe like skin your elbow. Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's what I want to do.
You want to both lose our dignity at the same time? Yeah.
You want to like remind yourself that you don't exercise at all?
Yeah, it's like two punches before you're winded.
Yeah,
it's
like
it's pretty amazing that this interaction is so well documented. Like, who is writing down? Oh, Jones says you're a liar, and then Sachs says you're a liar.
Well, it's not exactly like mind bending dialogue. So
yeah,
but it's also like the '60s after the Indianapolis 500. So like everyone's wearing like turtlenecks and sport coats and. Smoking cigarettes with like long extensions and drinking like there's like journalists
Hunter
all
S.
around
Thompson's
them.
There.
Yeah. Hunter S. Thompson's like, and then Penelope Jones said to Sachs that you're the liar. And after the fight, Sachs's wife Nance worked fast, taking some of her mascara to blacken his eye for photos. Damn, Nance, you a down ass biah. Then she put a miniature black flag in his mouth, telling reporters, quote, "His mouth has been black flagged." That was Eddie Sachs and his wife. The fans loved him, calling him the clown prince of racing. Eddie was convinced 1964 was going to be his year. He even told Nance that as soon as he won the Indy 500, he's going to retire from racing. It wasn't worth the risk. Dude, Nance is... tight.
Yeah. Where did she find a little tiny black flag?
She had it on her just in case, bro.
My guy's going to get in a fight, and I'm going to use this.
He runs his mouth. I can't wait till he gets in a fight so I can tell him he's been black flagged.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
So we have the history, the innovations, and the drivers. We got all the background. But what actually happened on that day in 1964? How did the race go down? As always, the race started with...
Gentlemen, start your engines.
As the green flag waved, the race got off to a clean start with Jimmy Clark, Parnelli Jones, and A.J. Foyt in front. In the third row was Lloyd Ruby, Len Sutton, and Don Branson. Behind in the fourth row was rookie Walt Hansgen and Jim
Herterbeast.
Drivers fighting for position were now running three and four wide as they approached the first turn. Two other rookies start up front, McDonald and Rooney Duman, who both moved to the bottom of the track. Sachs followed Herterbeast to the outside, moving in front of Johnny Rutherford. Sachs and Rutherford carried their momentum into the first turn, moving past Duman and McDonald. So Sachs and Rutherford are they got speed, they got a good run coming out of the first turn, moving past Duman and McDonald. And clinging to the inside of the track was one Bobby Unser. Drivers Marsham and Ward passed Jones on the back straightaway, and by the second lap, Gurney was past Jones and Foyt. McDonald passed Sachs and Rutherford on the low side between the first and second turns as they started lap number two. Rutherford said later that when he saw McDonald, he thought to himself, whoa, he's either going to win this thing or crash. McDonald was soaring. Maybe it was the combination of the slow start, crowded lines of cars in front of him, how well his Thompson car was handling with a full load of fuel, or maybe it was pure adrenaline. But McDonald was going big and driving aggressively, as he was known to do.
Like he's leasing a car from Rusnik.
Well, also, I mean, this car... Yeah, okay. That's pretty funny.
pretty funny.
That got me.
No one thinks it's pretty funny, Joe.
I think it's pretty funny. Joe's one of my favorite comedians, okay? I don't have to...
Thanks, dude.
McDonald was behind drivers Franson, Sutton, and Rothman. He passed all three of them before the fourth turn and moved into 10th place. So he's climbing up through the field. As Jim Clark approached the first turn, McDonald exited the fourth and was closing in fast on Hansgen, who in turn was closing fast on Herterbeest. That's the weirdest name ever.
It's very weird.
Herterbeest.
McDonald started edging his car to the left to pass Hansgen as they moved down the front straight, okay? So he's going to the inside. A split second later, Hansgen made the same move on Herterbeest, forcing McDonald to veer left again, so he has to go even further inside. Then it happened. McDonald lost control of the red Thompson. His car turned a full 180 degrees and went sliding backwards towards the inside wall. He had the front wheels turned in full opposite lock and the brakes jammed in an attempt to slow his car down. At the last second, he turned and hit the wall. The rubber bladder holding the car's gasoline was on the left side of the car, and even though the impact was on the right side of the car, the force of the crash tore the neck off the bladder from the refueling cap, shooting a stream of gasoline across the car and onto the hot exhaust pipes. The gas ignited, immersing the car in flames. McDonald's car hit the inside wall and bounced off of it, sending him back into oncoming traffic, completely engulfed in flames. The strength of the impact threw his car to the left another 180 degrees, and the nose of the car was headed towards the outside wall this time. The right rear suspension was destroyed on the initial impact and dug into the track, pivoting McDonald's car yet again, the jerking movement spilling more gasoline onto the fire. McDonald was sliding back across the track, pulling a screen of orange flames and dense black smoke behind him. Behind McDonald were the three drivers he had just passed, Branson, Sutton, and Rothman. All three drivers didn't hesitate. They stayed in the natural high groove coming out of the fourth turn, and running flat out, they made it past the sliding and burning car.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, that's insane. They were lucky enough to make it past, but not so lucky was Eddie Sachs. Coming onto the front stretch and closing fast was Sachs, followed at two car lengths by Rutherford and Dumont, running nose to tail. Unser was another car length back. As they came up on the fourth turn, they all saw a cloud of dust, and then they saw McDonald's car explode. All four drivers could see his burning car sliding back across the track. The whole circuit now was blocked with fire. All four drivers knew they couldn't stop. They had to drive through the flames. Sachs tried to find a break in the fire to make it through. He veered left and turned directly into the left side of McDonald's car. The left side, coincidentally, where the gasoline bladder was still intact. The collision punctured the Thompson's gas bladder and the front gas tank on Sachs' Shrike, touching off a second explosion with flames even greater than the first. Rutherford, Dumont, and Unser were right behind them. Sachs hit McDonald with such force that it lifted the rear of the Shrike completely off the ground. Rutherford, seeing this, jerked his steering wheel to the right in a desperate attempt to avoid Sachs and reached the narrow gap between McDonald and the wall, but he caught the right rear tire of Sachs' car, forcing Rutherford under the rear wheels before launching up and over McDonald's sideways racer.
Dude, this is just like a description of a nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, all of this is like, the whole time McDonald is on fire. Like, this man is burning. All these dudes are coming up on this like huge fire and then just like, and like now they're part of, like, just, yeah. I mean, this is why we have regulations in racing.
Yeah. Rutherford thought he was a goner. Then he burst free of the conflagration, his car on fire but still moving. Dumont swung left, and Unser's car hit him from behind, shoving Dumont into the flaming cars of Sachs and McDonald. Unser slammed into the rear of Dumont's car, pushing into the pyre, and then through the flames. Dumont bounced off the inside wall, clipped the rear of Unser's passing car, and slammed back tight against the wall. His car went rolling backwards towards the pit entrance. Holy crap, man. This is just a chain reaction of misery. Dumont got free of the crash only to see his car on fire. And his car is running on a fuel blend like the other offies, so the flames were almost invisible. Oh, man. Dumont managed to get free of his car. He jumped over the short inside track wall and started rolling in the grass, trying to put out the flames on his uniform. The safety patrol managed to get to him and sprayed him with an entire fire extinguisher and pulled him further from his now fully engulfed car. Unser thought he was free of the crash, but Dumont's car had hit him on the left rear suspension and turned his car back into Rutherford's. Rutherford's car was covered in pools of gasoline, and as he tried to pick up speed and get away from the crash, Unser's car slammed into his. Rutherford's car was airborne, going up and over the nose of Unser's car and back into the outside wall. But he finally managed to get into first gear and pull away after all that.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Just to have the wherewithal to, like, stay in it and stay, like, you know, not be phased.
For sure.
It's crazy.
Insane, dude. But now, Unser was trailing wreckage and his car was all torn up and missing a wheel. Unser's car rolled across the track towards the entrance to pit road. Unser climbed out of the car and managed to walk towards the pit. He was amazingly mostly uninjured, but had suffered just a few burns on his neck. Rutherford's fuel tank mounted underneath the tail of his car had been hit in the collision and was ruptured, and he was losing fuel. He drove his car past the pit lane that was clogged with people, so he kept on driving up the track. He wanted to keep moving so the flames on his car would either blow out or burn out. Very smart. At the flag stand, the race was ordered to stop. Only twice at Indy had a race been stopped, in 1926 and 1950, because of rain. Most drivers on the track had already stopped to avoid the flames. It was devastating, and everyone watching couldn't believe what they had just seen. The Indy 500 had stopped. Many drivers were injured, but Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald had both lost their lives. Sachs died in his car, and McDonald died at the hospital the next day. It was a huge loss for racing. Two drivers who couldn't have been more different. The race eventually started back up, and even though many of the racers were shaken up, every single one of them returned to their car to finish the race, with A.J. Foyt winning in the end. but it was a hollow victory. This was the year that Indy had stopped, and people wouldn't forget that anytime soon.
In the few weeks after the race, there was a lot of blame thrown around. AJ Foyt blamed the gasoline in the mid-engine car. Many others placed the blame solely on Thompson and his reckless, not thought-through car designs. In the press, there were calls to end the 500. The Chicago Tribune printed an editorial calling to end the Indy 500. A local CBS news anchor called for the end of the race. And the Washington Post sports editor said, "There is a new revulsion towards the speed carnival. The deaths and injuries will be listed as accidental, but the trappings for accident are built into the whole senseless spectacle." The negative press was plentiful, much of it aimed at Mickey Thompson. Car and Driver magazine said, "Hopefully, we have seen the last of Mickey Thompson at Indianapolis." To combat all the backlash and bad press, the USAC had a hearing where many people pointed fingers at Mickey Thompson. But after the dust settled and the blame was thrown in every direction, it was clear racing was too popular of a sport. The fans loved the Indy 500 and it wasn't going anywhere. But after 1964, the USAC did put in some more rules and regulations. It now required all fuel tanks to be made of metal with rubber bladder inserts and with minimum thickness requirements. No fuel tanks could be placed in front of a driver. Pressurized refueling was also banned. For the first time, a minimum vehicle weight of 1,250 pounds was set, and there were now required pit stops. And in 1965, the Indy 500 was back, with fans lining up to watch the race and drivers putting it all on the line to win. But the tragedy of 1964 wasn't for nothing. With all the innovation, there needed to be new regulations. And this blend of new technology, now combined with new safety regulations, cleared the way for another golden age of racing. Not only that, but for all his arguably dangerous and half-baked designs, Mickey Thompson may have had the last laugh. By 1967, every single car in the Indianapolis 500 was mid-engine.
Our source for this episode is a book called Black Noon, if you'd like to learn more. It's all about this huge tragedy. Yeah, man. I mean, to this day, like, you know, Indy cars remain mid-engined, and safety innovations are still going on with the inclusion of the aero screen for, I believe it was last season was the first season, maybe, or the season before that. Very recent. Essentially, like a windscreen, you know, and a sort of halo design that keeps cars from coming in, keeps large objects from entering the cockpit and you know, injuring drivers. And there was this
huge, it looks badass too.
It looks great. There was actually a big crash at the latest IndyCar. I think it was at Texas, where the halo definitely saved a lot of drivers from injury. So, you know, yeah. People might complain about safety getting more stringent in racing, and
you know who doesn't complain about it? Drivers.
Yeah, drivers don't complain about it. If you're watching racing for the crashes and the destruction, I think you're kind of in it for the wrong reasons. Because nobody wants to see a crash. So, yeah, safety is good, especially when these guys are just like some of the coolest figures in our kind of sphere, and you want to keep them safe. All right, well, that concludes this episode of Past Gas. So thank you very much for listening to Past Gas. As always, follow the show if you haven't. If you like this episode, follow the show. It really does help us out. It really does help us out. So
No cap,
dude.
It helps us out so much.
Follow my boys at Joji Weber, at James Pumphrey. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. I take pictures sometimes. That's my new
thing. You're really good, dude. You're getting so much better.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Check out Joe on Twitch. Check out Nolan on OnlyFans. if you like Nolan's Instagram content and you want to see the real stuff that Instagram won't let him post, check out Nolan J. Sykes on OnlyFans. It's pretty risky.
All right, that's enough.
That's enough.
Hey, if you want to get in contact with the show, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com. We have an email address now. We'll read them. We'll read the emails.
Yeah, we finally arrived in 1998.
Be kind. Have a good
one.
Keep
it juiced.
I love you.